Just before the episode begins, here's a reminder that we are on a website called On Podium, where you can find all our episodes, you can find blogs, you can register to become a guest, you can write reviews, you can subscribe from there, including our videos, which go onto YouTube. You can even donate if you want to support us. And what's the address, Nick?
So it's 2-5-1.onpodium.co.
On to the episode. Hello and welcome to 251. And this is our Christmas special, so it's not one of the 5-minute versions. We're going to be talking about George Shearing's Christmas album. My name's Simon Whiteside.
And my name's Nick Tomlin, and this is 251. Christmas with the George Shearing Quintet was recorded in 1998 on the Telarc jazz label, and it was a recording by his new quintet. Basically, George had established a quintet in 1947 initially, and it had gone through many different personnel changes. And then there was a period, really sort of late 70s through the 80s. He didn't really record with a quintet, but in the early 90s, he had the idea of putting a quintet back together, and that's what he did. So this is a recording with the kind of the new Shearing Quintet. And the personnel are, aside from obviously George Shearing on piano and vocal, which we'll go on to talk about, there's Don Thompson on vibes, Reg, I think you say Schwager?
Probably, yeah.
Reg Schwager on guitar, Dennis Mackerel drums, Neil Swainson on bass. And it's an album of, obviously, Christmas tunes. And what he's done is he's kind of mixed sort of popular Christmas songs, really, with some more traditional, I would say, carols, specifically kind of English. Well, there's also a French. But anyway, like traditional carols, really, I guess. Sometimes just performed even just solo. And, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting album. We're going to talk about it in a bit more detail. Simon, is there anything you want to add at this point?
The only thing I'd like to say about the personnel is the vibraphone player Don Thompson is really interesting. I've got him on a Paul Desmond album.
Oh.
He's playing bass.
Yeah, that's right. He's a multi-instrumentalist. Yeah, he plays all sorts of things.
And he plays bass really well as well.
Well, I think he actually played bass in the George Shearing Quintet and was replaced by Neil Swainson, I think in like 1988.
Right.
I think he spent a little bit of time playing bass. And he also plays piano as well, so he kind of, he's a sort of multi-instrumentalist.
Canadian. So that Paul Desmond album is the quartet album recorded in Canada live, and it's got Ed Bicker on guitar. But Don Thompson and the drummer, I can't remember who the drummer is, sorry, drummer, but they're all Canadians, I think.
Well, I think was that called his Toronto Quartet or something? I think it was like mid-70s, wasn't it, he had this quartet?
Yeah.
And in fact, like, so three of the five musicians are actually Canadian. I think it's just a coincidence, probably. Mm. But so the guitarist, Reg Schwager, is also Canadian, and he played with people like Zoot Sims, Pepper Adams, also played with Diana Krall, a bit more, I guess, more recently.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And then the other Canadian in the team is Neil Swainson, who had a very long partnership with George Shearing. I mean, he joined the quintet in 1988 as the bass player, and then he carried on playing with Shearing until Shearing's death in 2011. So he was a very long-running member of that band, and they also recorded quite a lot of duos together as well.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, he obviously really liked his bass playing.
Yeah, it's very. I mean, I like his melodic soloing. It's very melodic.
Yeah,
And you know, like what we talked about with the Sonny Clarke, it kind of all makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of them. I mean, particularly, you know, they're all very melodic players, very tasteful kind of swinging players. You know, I guess I think that's the kind of musician that he tended to like. You know, I guess.
So you're saying three Canadians, but Dennis Mackerel's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah, very good. I knew you'd. And you'd get a fish pen in there somewhere. So Dennis Mackerel is actually an interesting musician. I mean, he, and probably in some ways the sort of the highest profile apart from George, I guess, a member of the band. So his big claim to fame, really, we played with the Basie band from 83 to 87, and he was actually the last drummer that Count Basie personally selected to play to play in the band.
Yeah.
And then he also played with the Mel Lewis band, which later became the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra, and was apparently asked by Mel Lewis to actually take over the drum chair when Mel Lewis, I guess when he retired. So, and I think he's, well, you can tell he's primarily a big band drummer, but he also worked with like Hank Jones, and he, I mean, he's a, on the strength of this, he's a really versatile, really, you know, musical drummer.
Well, like you say, it's the whole thing is a is very tasteful, and I think we should get on to the tracks after this. So we're going to talk about the tracks one by one, and the first one on the album is Ding Dong Merrily on High. It was written in 1519, which is a long time ago, under the name Johann Tubereau. Probably badly pronounced, so any French speakers out there, you can come and tell me off. But it was basically a French... it was first included in a French collection of Christmas songs. And in Britain, it turned up in sort of 1800 and something, I think, in a collection of songs. But I think originally it was a secular dance piece that got carol words put to it.
I see.
But let's talk about how George Shearing approaches it. I mean, I would say it's a bit of a St. Thomas vibe, as in is it a calypso?
Yeah, it's kind of a calypso, I think.
I guess it is.
Yeah, kind of calypso swing, really, I guess.
And then it goes into swing, and there's a couple of solos by, really good solos by Don Thompson and John Snyder. No, I don't mean John Snyder, do I?
Reg Schwader.
I mean Reg Schwader. John Snyder was the producer, wasn't he? Overall, I mean, I think it's a bit of a bad one to start with. If I was organising this album, I wouldn't start with that one, because it is kind of what you would expect this to be, and it's of all of the tunes on there, it's the most plain vanilla,
sort of almost conventional,
almost lift music, I'm afraid, for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think personally it was just because it's a good one to blow on, and they all take quite good solos, so maybe that was the choice behind it. But I know what you mean. It's probably the least interesting kind of arrangement. He hasn't really done much to the tune, to the harmony. It's just kind of fairly straightforward, kind of, apart from the Latin swing, really.
I mean, there's that introduction.
They do a little introduction.
The outro-duction, that's the word.
Yeah.
But, it's just a bit, I don't know, it's just, I think it, I seem to remember when I was putting together a jazz compilation for a Christmas playlist, and I thought, oh, great, George Shearing's done one. What are they like? And I think this one put me off. And I don't think any got it on there in the end. But having said that, it's very George Shearing. But it sounds like a George Shearing arrangement, and obviously with the vibes and guitar.
Yeah, and they do the Shearing style block chord thing, you know. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, have you got any anything to add to that, or should we go on to the next one, which is more interesting?
Let's move on. So the next track is White Christmas, which obviously very, very well known Christmas song. Probably, I guess, one of the biggest selling Christmas
songs. Yeah.
It must be, I guess. The famous version being obviously Bing Crosby. He's done a really interesting reharmonization of this, and I actually transcribed it because I'm going to play a couple of these tunes. I've got a gig at the Spice of Life, 9th of December 2024, and we're doing a couple of these tunes. So I actually transcribed it, and it's a really interesting reharmonization he's done of this. So,
Is it a Shades of Shearing gig then?
With my band Shades of Shearing, where we obviously it's kind of
so you're doing stuff from your album,
doing stuff from the album, and I've throwing in a couple of Christmas songs
because of the season. Exactly. 'Tis the season to be cheesy.
Exactly. So I mean, in terms of it's kind of just a sort of walking ballad or sort of slow swing, I guess you would say, so in terms of the tempo. But it's just he's reharmonized it using these kind of it's kind of 2-5 kind of descending things. It's just an interesting reharmonization, I think. And then at the end, so they play the tune. They play the tune with this kind of reharmonization. There's a short solo, piano solo, and then they just modulate up. And so the last chorus is kind of a semitone up from the original. And then there's a nice little ending. And I think it's a really nice arrangement, actually, a really good arrangement.
Yeah, I think with all of these sorts of tunes that they can be quite. The standard version of them almost should never be done anymore by new people because it's too
obvious already.
Yeah, and also they have a tendency, because of Christmas being a time of, you know, wonder and peace and joy and all that sort of stuff, they tend to be quite schmaltzy, don't they, these tunes?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think, well... obviously, White Christmas was written for a film, wasn't it, by Berlin? But they can easily go into. I think you've got to try and do something with. I just did a string trio arrangement for a friend's, you know, wedding band, as it were, string quartet stroke trio, and I did it in a sort of cowboy tune, because I, you know, just didn't want to.
Do the usual kind of
do
treatment.
It
yeah,
yeah,
sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think with Shearing, I mean, part of the thing that attracted me to doing a band of his, really, what I find, and this is true of this album in a way, is that it's very, so the music's very accessible. You could put it on for somebody who doesn't know really anything about jazz, and they would listen to it and they would, you know, I think it's accessible.
Well, he was music. Very popular, wasn't he?
He was very popular. Mm. But having said that, there's enough, you know, there's some real musical detail in and I don't want to say all of these arrangements, but a lot of these arrangements, there's some very little, clever little musical ideas and I find it quite rewarding in a way to play his music because of that, because it's always very tasteful. And although he kind of, I think he treads this line between, like you say, tipping over sometimes into sort of schmaltz a little bit.
Hmm.
I don't know. He always manages to stay
it reminds me, actually, I think we both like. I mean, the reason I like the Dave Pal Octet is for a very similar reason: is that it's accessible, but it's also got enough jazz in it for someone who likes jazz to say, "Yeah, it's quite good." And there was a good description of that band, which I think fits the George Shearing whole thing really, which is. It won't offend the ear, but also it won't insult the intelligence. It's that level.
Yeah.
So should we talk about Winter Wonderland, which is the next tune?
Yeah.
So that's a 1934 tune by Felix Bernard with lyrics by Richard Bernhard Smith. I don't know if it's spelt different, so I'm assuming they're not related.
No.
And I like this one. It does get a little bit rinky-tinky in the head, but it's got that classic Shearing intro, hasn't it? That's a very Shearing way of doing a tune.
Yeah.
It reminded me of the things we did last summer on the Nancy Wilson.
Yeah, he's very good at writing these little intros, little unison intros. Mm. And they sound simple, but they're quite hard to do, I find. To make them kind of catchy, but at the same time, sort of memorable. I think they always kind of catch your ear, those little intros that he does.
Well, I think good arrangers, they have a tendency, you know, Nelson Riddle will always put something into a tune that you think of as part of that tune in the end.
Yeah, yes, that's true.
But
it
wasn't in the original. So, you know, sort of dung-ga-dung, ding-ga-dung, dung-ga-dung, ching-ching.
Yeah.
You know, that's all Nelson Riddle.
Yeah, but you sort of think that it's part of the tune in a way. Yes,
exactly.
True. Yeah.
And I think the solos are good on this. It is a kind of blowing vehicle, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they've kind of split them up into the ones that they just play in a more straight way and just have a blow in it, and then the ones that are more arranged. So I think there's a kind of... I've tried to vary a little bit, really.
Have you got anything further to say on that, or should we move on?
I think let's move on to the next one is the Christmas Waltz.
That's if I've got the details here.
Yeah.
So Jules Stein, Sammy Kahn wrote that, mm-hmm. and Frank Sinatra recorded it on as the B-side for his version of White Christmas.
Oh, okay.
And this I find, this is one of the things that makes this album better than I first thought it was, which is a sort of 3-4 bossa nova rhythm.
Yeah, it's a kind of Latin 3-4.
Yeah, yes, which right. is, I've not heard that rhythm really before, so I'm definitely nicking that one. I don't know if I like the rels or not. I haven't decided.
I mean, he talks about that in the... There's some quite good liner notes to this album where he actually talks about each song individually. And he talks about this one. He says that, for him, it's got a slight sort of Viennese feeling.
Yeah, that's what I took
waltz,
from it.
So that's why he put in those little retardandos to sort of suggest that, the Viennese waltz kind of thing. Which, yeah, I mean, yeah, I know what you mean. I'm not sure if they totally work. They kind of break up the flow a little bit, don't they, of the 3-4, but
I apologise to my music theory teachers. You are correct. They're ritardandos, not rels, because you only have a rel at the end officially, don't you?
Is that true? I don't know. I use them interchangeably. Rel,
yeah, rits in the piece and rel at the end. Oh, okay. But that's very much associated board theory book approach, and I think most people use them as
interchangeably. Yeah.
But I think you are right to say they're rits.
Right.
So I don't want any rits from my ex. Theory teachers. I did like it. I liked it more when it was kept going, I have to think. You know,
yeah,
in the blur,
yeah, because I
in
think once
blowing.
You get into that groove, it sort of to keep breaking it up sort of slightly.
The thing about Johann Strauss and those sorts of waltzes is that there's already there's a kind of a swing in those performances.
They're not completely metrical, are they?
No, sort of one.
It's
like the two is a bit long.
Yeah.
And they are musical writs in the sense of they usually go between sections.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder whether they overdid them. Perhaps,
possibly.
You know, it's a relaxing. It's it's to let people dancing take a little bit of time.
Okay.
You know, on turns and things. Mm. So yeah, it's. But overall, I liked it, and I definitely like that rhythm. I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
because they still have that. They sort of get the. They get the 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. So it's almost like... It's in 4-4, but it isn't in 4-4.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's interesting.
I mean, it did... The first few bars did... I was falling over a bit. And it's like, oh, what's going on? Oh, yeah, it's in 3, not 4. Mm.
Makes you wonder if George Shearing came up with that or whether the drummer, that was just something the drummer sort of
added. I mean, it's really... I've certainly not heard that before.
Mm.
So the next track is, unless you have anything further to say on that.
No, let's move on.
The next track is Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. By the way, we've done a couple of Christmas specials already, and one of them we went through our sort of top, was it 5 or 6? I can't remember how many we did now.
Yeah.
But this was one of them, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, if you want to listen to the kind of more of the history of the tune.
Yeah, we go into more the kind of the history of how they were written and their performance history and stuff. So
etc. Yeah. So, but it was written by Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine, and Judy Garland first sang it in the 1994 MGM musical Meet Me in St. Louis.
Mm.
But I found this really, really interesting. There's a sort of peal, what I would call a peal of bells double time vibe.
Yeah.
And that melts into swing. See what I did there? Snow reference. In regular time. But what's strange about it is that how do you feel about it? About that change?
What from the because they do this kind of
sort of double time, isn't it?
Yeah,
and the drummer's in double time.
Yeah, I think it
kind
of works. I think it works pretty well. The arrangement.
And then at the end of the tune, as in the statement of the head, which is the first time through the tune, there's a quote from Joe Zawinul's Birdland.
Yeah, which is a bit incongruous when you sort of first hear it, you know. But
well,
it
if
kind
you
of
know
works,
it, if yeah. you know what it is, it's
yeah.
incongruous. But it
yeah.
works perfectly
yeah,
fine
so
if
it
you
works
don't
really,
know what it
oh,
is.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure, sure, yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was quite interesting because, of course, George's most famous tune is Lullaby of
yeah.
Birdland.
Yeah, I don't know if that's I don't know why if that's why he sort of included it, but it does it definitely works in, musically, you know.
And then there's a Fugato section, which yeah. is quite. I mean, that's more sort of a almost like a John Lewis
yeah,
modern
yeah,
jazz quartet
yeah.
Reference, I suppose.
Yeah, although he did. I mean, even with his early quintet, he did. He sort of experiment with fugue, fugal kind of ideas between the. So I think he's always. I mean, he's all the way throughout his career. He was very influenced by classical
yeah.
music, and he was a very good classical pianist as well. So
we'll talk about that
yeah.
the next tune, won't we?
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
But I mean, there aren't any solos, are there?
No, it's just a an arranged, purely arranged sort of treatment, isn't it? All the way
yeah.
through.
Yeah, really. And I actually thought this is one of the ones that works better.
Mm.
I'm not 100% sold on the double time into half time or double time into normal time, whatever you want to call it.
Mm.
Not 100% certain I like it, but it does work.
Mm.
And there's a very much that peal of bells vibe, which works obviously with vibraphone. You've got
you've
got bells.
So. Well, so it's quite good. I mean, I think the instrumentation is quite good for a Christmas album.
Yeah,
with the vibes, and it sort of creates this, like you say, sort of bell
sparkle
chime like effect. I mean, it's worth just mentioning that he in the liner notes he does a really good name drop. So he just casually mentions that he actually heard Ralph Blaine sing this at a party that Ralph Blaine had thrown, and he said his rendition brought tears to everybody's eyes in the room. So it's quite a nice little name drop he puts
yes.
in there.
But, well, Larry Adler was always good at that, and in fact, his autobiography is called "Name Drops Keep Falling on My Head."
Is that true?
Yeah. Right, so the next tune is a French traditional tune. It was one of my favourite carols, actually, Noël Nouvelle.
Oh, I didn't know this carol at all.
It's I started my musical journey in singing a lot of choirs, church choirs, and I used to like doing this one at Christmas. But this is what you spoke about, very much, I would say, sort of classical set of variations on a theme.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty inventive, actually.
Yeah.
I would say, particularly within the confines of jazz. So he's taking it right to the... I think this would be challenging for some more middle-of-the-road...
Possibly, yeah.
...jazz listeners who might skip this track and go on to the Donkey Carol. But... So the theme itself is over sort of a mysterious, slightly dissonant pedal, isn't it?
Yeah, he does this. I don't quite know what he's doing there. He's obviously playing very low on the piano with the pedal and creating this kind of
rumble.
I don't exactly know what he's doing, but it's quite effective. And then you have the theme just played very sparsely in the right hand over, and it creates this kind of very atmospheric sort of sound.
And I would, because it's a modal tune, it kind of works like that quite well. So we'll discuss where you think these come from, but the first variation is quite dissonant, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I've put modern style, but I think I would reference Stravinsky probably. I don't know. You've got the liner notes. Perhaps he says
he talks more about the song itself. He doesn't really talk about what inspired him in terms of the performance. But I mean, I hear very much Debussy. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of, you know, the Submerged Cathedral. You know,
It's a bit too dissonant for Debussy, though, I think.
Some of Debussy's. Particularly that work. Do you know that work?
I played that for my music college audition.
Yeah, but he has the same effect, doesn't he? Where he has these very rumbling kind of, I just reminded me a little bit of that.
I think the main theme has more similarity. You know, when he does the main theme.
Yeah, yeah.
And the next, I would say the next one, the next variation is very French sounding.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I found that more to be like the parallel, almost that neoclassical period Stravinsky reminded me of. But you know, I'm sure both could be made to work as an argument because there are connections to all of it. So variation two, I would say, is a sort of Ravel French style, Debussy French, very the harmony,
particularly, is
quite interesting. And then version three, I mean, did you have anything about variation two to add?
No.
Variation three has got a bit more counterpoint in it, hasn't it? And he also ends with a T.S. de Picardy, which is which my A-level music teacher used to call a Lester Picardy, which is where you go to the major third rather than the minor third the end.
Yeah.
And then I thought version four, variation four, kind of went back in time a bit. So a bit more, I kind of get a French thing overall. I mean, and that's probably partly because it's a French tune.
French carol, yeah.
But I kind of felt that there was a sort of Chopin-like way of doing it, but not quite. I mean, if someone was to do a proper Chopin parody on it, they would be a lot more florid.
Mm.
But it felt like it was an earlier version of...
Yeah.
And then we return...
It returns back to the original...
To the rumbling bass.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder how much of that was improvised or whether it was all written. I mean, you know, it's interesting.
Well, the way he plays it, to me, there's no... I don't hear any thinking.
No.
I don't hear any thinking time.
So you think he pretty much worked it out, what he was...
Because when you hear those Keith Jarrett flowing introductions that he's famous for, you still get the occasional point where it's like, where am I?
Yes, that's true.
And what am I doing next?
Yes,
does a bit of sort of swimming on...
Although he was very good at improvising. He could improvise in classical style. Mm. You know, he could... I think he used to do it. Parties, people would just say, can you play so-and-so in the style of Chopin, and he could improvise in, you know...
I'm not saying it was written down.
No.
What I mean is it
was
planned.
It was worked out. It was planned, sure. Yeah.
So I'm going to do this one like this, and do this one like this, and then I'm going to go... Because it's a bit too structured to be not...
Improvised. Yeah, no, I think you're right, yeah.
And none of the variations go out of character, do they?
No.
I mean... We could only ask him, but we don't have a Ouija board. So, right. Well, the next one is a really nice version of John Rutter's Donkey Carol.
Mm.
For those of you who are strictly jazz heads, John Rutter is a backbone of English choral writing of the 20th century. Mm. When I was in choirs. There was a new John Rutter every year, and they were always good, and everyone always did them, and still do them.
A sort of classic, when you hear sort of carols from kings,
there'll be a John Rutter in there somewhere.
Rutter,
And of course, he was at Kings at one point.
Yeah.
So he was in a long line of, you know, David Wilcox, Philip Ledger, the late, great Stephen Clebury, and, you know, that tradition, I mean... my son's at Cambridge at the moment, and his college is not the oldest, and it was founded in 13 something. So I think King's College may have been founded. Actually, King's College may be later, but some of those, of them were founded in 11 something.
Yeah.
You know, it's, so there's a tradition going back
hundreds of years, really.
Hundreds and hundreds of years. Yeah. So what I found. But the thing is with John Rutter, I always think he is a pop song writer who writes for choirs, so they're always very singable.
Yeah,
and people like the congregations like them because they are very singable tunes, very relatable tunes.
Yeah.
But he clothes those in choral tradition.
Mm.
So and there's a new there's someone who writes like this now. Bob, can't remember his name. Chilcott. Bob Chilcott is the sort of successor of that.
Right.
In fact, he went to Merchant Taylor School, which I didn't realise until recently, but there's a sort of poppy people's tune, if that makes sense. About, but I think the way that these two, though both of those composers and others, they clothe it in choral tradition, and therefore it becomes not syrupy. And, although John Rutter's always quite sort of emotional stuff. So putting it into a jazz context, it could easily be really quite dripping in honey. And I think doing it in 5/4 is a cunning ruse to to make it much more jazz, I suppose. And I love that bass line in the beginning and end.
That's
a ding 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 ding.
Well, there's obviously a nod to sort of Take Five in
Take Five. I mean, there's that is definitely a Take Five start, but there's also that that's not the one with the actual Take Five theme, though, is it? Is it?
That's the one. So it starts with the.
Isn't it God Rest You Merry Gentlemen that has the actual Take Five?
Oh, hang on, sorry, I think I made a mistake.
The Donkey Carol, I think, it's got like a sort of like a bass ostinato, and then it drops down.
That's right.
And it's a really nice sort of counter melody.
So you
say from the liner notes that there was some interaction between them.
Yeah, well, he thanks John Rutter for helping him with the liner notes. I presume probably it's the historical stuff, because he talks a little bit about these, especially these older carols and the history a little bit. And he sort of thanks John Rutter for that. So he must have obviously been in communication with John Rutter.
I can't remember. I'm just going to check, actually. If there's anything you'd like to say, I'll check when John Rutter was at King's, because it could have been that period when he was... the main guy, although I think by then he wasn't. But have you got anything else to say about that, or would you like to start talking about I'll Be Home for Christmas and I can look up John Rutter?
I'll start talking about I'll Be Home for Christmas.
I'll tell you that the lyricist was Kim Gannon and the composer is Walter Kent.
Yeah, and I mean, George writes about this a bit in the liner notes, but... this song was written 1943, so it was during the Second World War. And the lyrics obviously refer to the plight of soldiers kind of stuck overseas, away from families for Christmas. So it's, I'll be home for Christmas. And he kind of mentions that really in the liner notes. And they play it as a kind of... I sort of... term this a kind of Shearing ballad. Shearing, it's almost like he kind of invented this way of playing ballads, where it's basically the whole band. So he's playing his block chord style, and the band are playing the guitar and vibes are sort of playing the melody in this kind of just one kind of melodic line. It's very effective, you know. It's very much a sound, you know. But it works well. It's a great tune. Have you come up with anything in terms of John Rutter?
Yes, he was. He did go to Clare College as an undergraduate, and he was director of music from 75 to 79 at Clare. I've got recordings of that of Clare College choir singing his stuff.
Yeah,
but he also. Worked with John Wilcox as one of the key arrangers on Carols for Choirs, which is the Carols for Choirs book were still the staple of the Christmas. I think there were two volumes of it, and the second one came out while I was a chorister in the 80s.
Right, okay.
And then there was a version 3, which was for girls' voices, high voices. So he wasn't ever at... King's, but he obviously worked with Wilcox at that time. So that's presumably the connection he was... that was the connection with George Shearing talking to him about these various older carols because of his... Particularly Carols for Choirs. Carols for Choirs... There's so many John Rutter in there. The only thing I would say is I've got a feeling that he may attempt to quote Calling All Workers in it.
In I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Yeah, you all know, right.
I kind of missed that. I don't think I even know that song.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you might be right, because he does, he's definitely in a quoting mood, because he puts quite a few quotes in this album, doesn't he?
He does.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
So you could well be right. I don't think I know that song, so I probably didn't.
Well, it was a radio. It was a home service. The thing is that it was in the war. It was very.
So it's very possible, because he definitely references the war and the men overseas, and so he was sort of thinking of that when he did it.
So the show would be broadcast in factories.
And
the reason it was called "Calling All Workers" is because it was for factory workers. It was popular songs. I think it was the Home Service that did that, and it had this. Like Holiday for Strings, that sort of music.
Yeah, he could. I mean, it could well have.
That's a theory, not necessarily a fact. So you'll be able to find it on Donald Trump's Truth Social as fact. Snowfall.
Snowfall.
I didn't know this one very well.
Oh, okay.
It was written by Claude Thornhill, apparently.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of his theme, became his theme song, basically.
Right.
So they would play it as the band's theme, basically.
Yeah.
1941 is when it was written. And it's become a kind of a Christmas standard. I mean, I think it's become better known. People have started to. I mean, I did a 2 years ago, I did a Christmas album with the saxophonist Mark Alloway, and we just as a duo, and we did some, and we included it as a Christmas song, and it's nice. I mean, it's very arranged, I mean, he plays it in quite a faithful way. I mean, if you listen, did you listen to the original?
No, I didn't actually.
But it's obviously, you've got the bass line, and everything's kind of quite arranged in it. You can't do too much with it.
That bass line is what I sometimes refer to as a cowboy feel.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
that sort of. Always expect to hear a bit of harmonica. and it goes into swing, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's kind of swing section in the middle, and then it goes back to this kind of, it's sort of like an ostinato bass figure, really, with these. It's quite atmospheric when you hear it's worth listening to the original orchestration of it.
We talked about Claude Thornhill in relation to his. Influence on
Gil Evans,
yeah. And yeah. Hence Birth of the Cool.
Yes, that's
and
right.
Hence the Mal Torme stuff with Marty Page.
Yeah, he was very hugely influential arranger, Claude Thornhill, actually.
Well, shall we move on?
Yeah. So Let It Snow. Have you got the details of who wrote this?
Yeah, it was a 1945 tune written by Sammy Kahn and Jules Stein.
Oh, again, another one.
And this is a kind of bebop one for me. It's got that bebop-y introduction, hasn't it?
Yeah,
And then it has what I describe normally as a mobile two-feel. So it's two-feel, but it's joined up quite a bit by the bass player.
Yeah.
So instead of just going dum,
yeah,
dum,
yeah,
dum, it's like
yeah.
Boom, boom, ba dum, dum, gung, gung, dum,
yeah.
Ba dum, boom, gung, gung. So, and what I really like is that has that famous downward, but they keep going.
They keep going. Well, he sort of mentions that he says you've got to watch out for the extra, because normally it's Let It Snow 3, but he sort of adds a couple of extra Let It Snows in the arrangement.
Exactly, and there's a lot of. I like those extensions because it kind of. I like those things. I mean, Mozart was very good at that. Everyone thinks that classical music's written in 8-bar sections, but if you analyse Mozart, you realise he'll stick in 7 and 9-bar sections just to. But they never feel unnatural.
No.
And that doesn't feel unnatural to me.
No. And it's got that little kind of drum break at the end of each of those phrases, which kind of So it's a really effective.
I think it's one of his. My favourite arrangements, actually, on this. And there's also, we've talked about this with Claude Thornhill, but he also does quote Boplicity.
Yeah, he does a really nice little block chord solo, which is his sort of, his claim to fame, really, sort of.
Yeah.
he didn't invent it, but he used this block chord sort of technique, and he plays a solo, and then, he quotes is it Miles Davis tune? It's kind of credited, isn't it, as Miles Davis?
Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah, Bob Listy, which is on Birth of the Cool, as well. So,
I mean, the definitely Gil Evans and Jerry Mulligan were hugely important. The arranging on that album.
Yeah,
but you know, it could have been a Miles Head that they arranged.
Yeah, yeah. And they all play really good solos on this. I mean, you can tell they're all really, really accomplished soloists. I think they deliberately kind of rein it in. It's not a kind of a blowing jazz session, is it?
No.
You know, but you can hear when they take solos that they're always really, really good solos.
It's like Nat King Cole, isn't it? But all the players in his trio were really good improvisers, he's a very good improviser, very good piano player, but he never sort of shreds on
it. No, it's all within the arrangement, and it's quite sort of restrained in a way.
And linear and understandable.
Melodic, I mean, it's interesting, it's just worth mentioning, and I really noticed it on this album, that George Shearing, his style, I feel it's kind of rooted more in swing. I mean, although he's kind of associated with bebop, you know, that he wrote sort of bebop tunes like Conception.
Mm.
But his feel is, I feel is more linked with kind of Nat Cole, Teddy Wilson, those kind of players, his kind of quaver feel. And also he does it quite a lot on this album as well. He'll do the comping on the four kind of feel.
Remember, I was going to mention, I think I wrote it down, so we either haven't got to it yet or I've forgotten to mention it, but there was one of the solos is really quite swing.
Swing, yeah. He definitely has that in his playing, more than bebop in a way. I mean, he's got bebop phrases that he plays, but the feel, I feel, is still more in the kind of the swing sort of vein than the bebop in a way, you know. General, but
I know what you mean. Mm. I mean, he's one of those players with a foot in the past.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
But this album, quite late in his career, I guess, was obviously using a lot more of the reharm thing that was going on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, he's very. But I mean, he was doing. I mean, it's interesting looking at. Because I've transcribed quite a lot of those earlier quintet arrangements, and they're really sophisticated harmonically. He does some really sophisticated stuff in the 50s, you know, which you sort of associate almost with later. Like he does, there's an arrangement of, I can't remember the tune, but he does an arrangement, there's an arrangement he does of a standard, and it's modal. He uses chordal voicings. I mean, this was in the early 50s, I would think, early 50s probably. Mm. And it's all chordal voicings, the whole treatment, you know, which again is really became only common in jazz much later. So he's always had this really sophisticated harmonic conception.
You mentioned the Sunken Cathedral, and that does contain chordal and quintal voices.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think people like Bill Evans were aware of those.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
That fourth gap. But didn't really employ it in the same way. Well, not in the modal way that then
McCoy Tyner
and Herbie Hancock and people did.
No,
I think probably we'll have a very short interlude, and then we'll wrap up the last four songs and the whole album, and finish off.
Mm-hmm. So next we have the Christmas song, which is a staple of Christmas holiday CDs, albums.
Still my favourite, I'm afraid.
Mm.
I'm not afraid. I'm quite proud of it, to be honest.
And in the liner notes, George kind of recounts the famous story of its kind of inception, which we actually talk about in some depth in the previous podcast.
We'll put a link to the two other Christmas. Or is it? Have we done two or three other ones?
Two, I think.
So we'll put the link to those. I'll put them in the show notes so you can find it easily.
Yeah. So he talked about that, and I mean, they perform it fairly straightforward. They do put in a couple of little harmonic variations, which are quite nice. But
well,
fairly
are they?
No, you don't. Okay, all right. Okay.
I think it's a song with lots of rehums in it already.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, yes.
And I think reharming the rehums might.
Yeah, maybe. Although he doesn't. I mean, it's quite tasteful. It's just. The odd little corner here and there.
Yeah,
put in it,
it is.
But I know what you mean, though. It is. I mean, the song itself already is quite sophisticated and harmonically. Yeah.
And I think I'm not only he uses the sort of Nat King Cole version. So that dung 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 da da dung that business, which isn't the original. I don't think that is the original chords.
No,
but the it is fine, but I don't think it's a tune that needs
too much fiddling around with.
Yeah. No, I think reharmonization works sparingly.
Yeah,
And I just wonder whether something that's already quite.
Yeah, I see. What you, yeah,
move,
yeah,
you know, moving into strange places. Or, but it may be that I just like this song so much.
You don't want anybody to mess around with it too.
Yeah,
much.
I mean, I've done the other arrangement I did for this string quartet I was talking about. They're called the Martin String Quartet, by the way. Is the Christmas song, and I did chuck in one extra on the way down, on the way out, on the A section. I did the old, which George Shearing uses a lot, that augmented fourth descending.
Yes. Yeah,
so you'd start on an F sharp half diminished and go down.
Yeah.
And I think, and I did that on.
It works well on this tune.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
But I think it does work pretty well. I'm probably being a bit. Precious about it, but at the end I find a bit weird. It kind of almost has an interrupted cadence end, doesn't it? But it isn't, but it sounds kind of like it's not the home key. But I haven't worked out whether it actually is the home key or not.
I mean, he does that on, I've noticed on a few endings where he kind of ends, doesn't end well, he kind of ends, doesn't always end in the home key. He sometimes at the very end he'll modulate into a different key, which kind of, I think it's obviously deliberate. You know, it's deliberately done, but it does kind of leave the slight sense of unresolved sort of feeling at the end.
I can't remember whether this one actually does finish in as it were, the wrong key or not.
I can't remember, but I think it does finish in the... he just does... Yeah, it's a little kind of harmonic shift at the end, isn't it? Which, I know what you mean.
But, again, I guess you'd call it a walking ballad, would you?
Yeah.
Kind of tempo.
Yeah, yeah.
So on to... another traditional God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. I don't think there's anything particular to say about the composition of that, is there? Unless you've got something written
out. No.
I just think of it as a traditional tune. But this is the one with the Take Five vamp at the beginning.
Yeah, funny enough, he doesn't actually mention that at all. But it's obvious that he's basically taken the voicings exactly from...
Yeah.
He actually mentions, he said that it was inspired by a version that he heard the King Singers... do. They just did it in five, and then he sort of thought that it was good to do it in five. Although actually it's not strictly in five, is it? Because he switches between 5/4 and 4/4.
Yeah, and that's and we're in a weird place as well. So he's got the 5/4 vamp.
Yeah.
And it goes into four on bar at the beginning of bar 12.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's seven. I thought maybe they were doing that to get eight bars in. But actually, there's only seven bars of that before they go back into 5/4 on the last chord.
Yeah, it is. It is slightly unusual that. Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, it's a tune that I've done a 5/4 version of this tune, which I renamed "Knock Chill Ye Solid Gone Gentle Cats" because that's like how I am, a bit of a twat. But and it works really well in 5/4.
Yeah,
because I think it's. Well, the thing about the Take Five, I think I may have said this before, the thing about Take Five is it's in 4/4. There's just the first two beats are long and the second two beats are short. So anything that's in 4/4 can, in theory, be given this treatment.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does seem to work quite well for things in three as well, because you have the triplet, the three-note, two-note, two-note kind of option there. So you can shorten often, like the, you know, you can drop a beat from a three, quite easily.
Yeah.
I like the vibe solo on this a lot, actually. And then there's guitar and piano solo following, isn't it? It's another one of the blowing tunes. The end, isn't this another one where they go to the major at the end?
Yeah.
With a bit of a slower, bit of a slowing up.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so overall, I thought pretty successful arrangement, this one.
Mm.
Have you got any further thing to
No,
add?
I don't think so. I think we'll move on to, well, how do you pronounce this?
Balulalo.
Balulalo.
Which I have sung in, again, carols for choirs.
Mm.
Peter Warlock wrote some really nice stuff, actually. There's a few things in carols for choirs by him. And he was a part of the English folk, kind of folk tradition stroke. You know, the classical composers who used folk music as their root. And that's not his only name, Peter Warlock. He's got a... He's the guy who wrote the Capriole Suite.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know the name. Yeah.
So that it's the Peter Erskine Trio. They do Pièces en l'air from that.
Okay.
No, so that's Capriole Suite was written by an early English composer. Mm. I can't remember which one, whether it was William Byrd or someone like that.
Mm.
But from that period of William Byrd, Orlando
sort
Gibbons,
Renaissance
those sort of people.
Yeah.
And so he reorchestrated that for string orchestra.
Mm.
And, yeah, he wrote some really nice carols. And this, I think it is it's taken from
In the liner notes, the text is from 1567. I think it was a Scottish poem. Text, which Peter Warlock set in 1925 is when... I only know this because of the liner notes. George Shearing goes into it, you know, in the liner notes. And again, this is another... He's obviously thinking of, you know, these in a slightly different way to the others, isn't he, in a way? It's more definitely more classical, again, this interpretation of this carol.
Yeah, his real name is Philip Arnold Heseltine.
But Peter Warlock definitely sounds more, I don't know how, sort of, I don't know who to say.
Yeah, he's definitely, he was definitely, you know, in that, you know, the sort of, what's that place in Camden Town? There's a folk music centre in Camden Town. Named after Cecil Sharp.
Yeah, Cecil Sharp House. Okay, yeah. Okay.
He's in that kind of milieu.
Yeah.
Elizabethan music and all that sort of stuff.
And English folk music kind of. Tradition.
Yeah, but I like it. And I like the kind of changes of register. And again, it's one of those, you can really hear his classical touch in this.
Yeah.
And I also like the way it links to the next track. And it's almost like the beginning of the... Away in a Manger is a hangover from the previous track.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have anything further to say on Balulalu?
No. I think let's move on. As you've already mentioned, that it kind of leads into Away in a Manger, which is the next track. I mean, it's kind of quite amusing. He in the liner notes says that he has a disagreement with his wife about which was the correct tune for this carol. This is one of those carols that has two different tunes, isn't it? There's a few of them, like In the Bleak Midwinter is another one which has two. George sort of preferred what he thought of as the English version, and his wife maintained that it was the German. Well, she thinks it was written by Martin Luther, the German version. But then I think they found out, they looked into it and they found it was neither. It was actually by an American, but from the Lutheran tradition in America, who actually wrote the song. But it's
who wrote which one?
Who wrote the? I think the Martin Luther, the other one.
Not this one. Yeah, I think in Britain, Away in a Manger is the most often done. But the other Away in the Manger is in Carols for Choirs 2, I think.
Okay, all right. Okay,
And this one's in Carols for Choirs 1.
It's funny how you get very attached to these, I suppose because you sort of sing them when you're a child, and somehow singing the wrong tune to a carol just seems a bit...
Because you know hymns are written in meter, like sonnets.
Yeah.
So quite often you can just literally play do the words from one hymn to
well,
the tune of another.
Well, there's quite a few hymns, aren't there, which have the same tune, different words. Yeah. Just, and in fact, I think like very often hymns are known by, you know, the actual name of the hymn is. I mean, I don't know much about choral music, church music, but, you know, the hymn tune is given a name, isn't it? So it's whatever, the Winchester or something, and then, and then, you know...
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a it's known in its own right as a tune, and then you can put different words to it. So,
As we've said, it starts similar to Balu Lalo, and then the band comes in, and it's one of those many substitutions are occurring. but it works for me. It works all right when you
because it's very simple. Because it's very simple. Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And I've got here a modestly dissonant out chorus, which goes into that famous lullaby that they use in cartoons, doesn't it?
Da da dee da da. Yeah, yeah. He ends it with the lullaby. Yes, yeah. Is that Brahms?
I think it. Isn't, but maybe it is.
Maybe it is.
I think it's not by someone famous, not by a classical composer, but I might be wrong.
Oh, I might be wrong as well.
but yeah, he kind of goes into that as Away in a Manger is obviously sort of supposed to be a lullaby, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
And we're going to finish off the album with a... It's a little bit of a surprise when George dusts off the vocal cords and gives us a rendition of It's Christmas Time.
Yeah. So, I mean, I did have a brief look around. I don't think there's any other example of him actually singing on an album. I don't think he's actually sung on an album before. So it's probably the first, maybe one and only time that he actually sings. But he's actually okay. I mean, he's got a very...
he's got a pleasant voice.
Pleasant voice, yeah. pleasant voice. And it's quite an undemanding song to sing in a way. It's actually it's a really nice song. I mean, I kind of worked out...
There's some nice chords in it.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, it's a really nice nice song. But again, he mentioned... So the composer is this guy called Jack Sweeney, and he just mentions that he's from California, and I sort of looked him up, and I couldn't find anything else that he's written. So I don't know, but George sort of says that he thinks it should be a kind of Christmas standard, which it could be really. I mean, it's a good enough tune, I think.
Have you taken down this one then?
Well, I worked it out in terms of the I just worked out the tune.
I'd be interested to get that from you actually, because I would like to sing this one.
Yeah, it's a really nice tune and very Christmassy somehow. It's I don't know. It's got that kind of there's that elusive Christmas sound, isn't there? That I don't know quite what it entails, but this song definitely has it.
And it was bugging me at the end.
Oh yeah,
there's a quote.
Yeah,
and I knew it. I knew I'd sung it.
And I recognised it, but I didn't know what it was.
And it's actually a very old English tune called "Here We Come A Wassailing."
Oh, okay.
And John Rutter did arrange it for Clare College.
Ah, okay.
Choir.
So that's obviously okay. That's interesting.
And I've sung that, but not. I knew it.
Yeah.
It was like, and it's not the beginning of it either. It's the middle of it.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So on there's a couple of Clare College albums. One's on Naxos and it's on that. So if you fancy looking it out in its more Cambridge-y setting.
Yeah, so that's probably... He probably did that as a deliberate little reference to...
quite possibly with the John Rutter connection.
It's interesting.
So, it's a well-integrated album overall, I'd say. As in, you know, there's a lot of linkage across from different tunes, like the John Rutter connection here.
And I think it's... I can tell he's thought about it. I mean, I think sometimes these kind of Christmas albums can be a little bit kind of just thrown together.
Let's do a
Christmas album. But there's quite a lot of thought gone into it. And the arrangements are, you know, they're good arrangements. They're not just kind of, apart from maybe the couple where they have literally just kind of played the tune in a sort of jazz style. But you know, for the majority, there's been some care taken over the arrangements, I think. And I like the older carols. I like the reference to the older carols and the way he's sort of treating those differently. And yeah, it's a good album to check out, definitely.
And overall, I think the only thing for me is it suffers slightly from the sound of that particular lineup is because there's no blowing instruments, they're all plucked or hit instruments. It does, after a while, that sound wears on me a bit. I mean, I used to listen to I love the vibraphone. And in fact, when I was sort of 16, 17, I listened to loads of modern jazz quartet and George Shearing, and I absolutely loved it. But it
you can have too much of a good thing.
Yeah, it is a bit like having strawberries and cream consistently and never having any anything else. So it is very pretty, I suppose. That's the and also there's a hell of a lot of high frequency stuff going on with piano, guitar, and vibes, which is what gives it the So, like you said, it's very suitable because often people get the sleigh bells out and the glockenspiels, don't they, for Christmas tunes, and bells, and you know, the carol of the bells and all that sort of stuff, and the pealing of bells at Christmas. It all links together, but. Really, overall, a pretty, you know, a good solid Christmas album.
And it's the sound quality is really good. I think the actual recording of it is really good.
Yeah, we were going to talk a little bit about Telarc, weren't we?
Yeah. So it came out on this Telarc, the sort of the jazz imprint, really, of Telarc. So I did make some notes on this.
Well, if I remember rightly, they set up as a high quality audio file.
Yeah, 1977 it was set up.
And it was like pre-CD, but they were recording digitally early. I think that was the idea.
Yes, that's right.
So when CDs became common, they were sort of ahead of the game. And their idea was, I think, to record classical music primarily.
Yeah, I mean, it was set up by two classically trained musicians, Jack Renner, Robert Wood, set up in 1977. And it started off as a classical label, but they did eventually go on to release jazz and I think folk as well. From between 89 and 2005, they actually... and it still exists, but now I think it's part of the Concord label. It's been kind of...
Yeah, well, everything. There's only like three record companies now, so it'll be owned by either Universal, Warner or Sony.
Yeah, but I think it comes under the Concord label or whatever. But it's a good... It's for 1998, it's a really good sound. I mean, well recorded.
I mean, the piano sounds particularly good, doesn't it? I mean, for us pianists who listen to lots of pretty dodgy pianos, badly recorded over to jazz history, that you can, especially on those solo ones, you can really hear the richness of the piano, which often gets lost in recordings. But yes, and also it's got, I guess it's got that slightly classical headroom in there, as in it's not in your face. Mm. It's a bit more distant.
Yeah.
A bit more in the room. Does it? I didn't find out where it was recorded.
It was recorded in New York. I can't remember the studio, but it was in New York. It was a New York studio. I don't have it to hand. But
no. Was East Street still around at that time?
Not sure.
No, that's where Kind of Blue was recorded. That was Columbia's recording studio. Anyway, it's got a kind of slightly roomy sound to it to me. But you don't. Put it this way: like many good jazz recordings, I don't hear the room. I'm hearing the music.
Yeah, sure.
And I mean, Van Gelder was good at that because he didn't have a room. Well, he had his parent started out with his parents' front room, but when he did have a room, so when he moved to is Englewood Cliffs, isn't it?
Yeah,
where he moved
to,
then he kind of built that like a church.
Yeah,
and there's a feel, there's a kind of classical feeling about that vibe. You know, there's some air in the room that the microphones are not in your face.
Yeah, I mean, maybe because I guess that's how you would tend to record classical music more. You know, it's more of a classical approach, isn't it, I guess, to recording.
Yeah, I mean, classical music is fundamentally recorded in stereo. I mean, with some classical recordings, just a stereo pair. Most commonly, what's called a decatree, which is left, right, and the centre. So you get a full... Because the trouble with stereo is you sometimes get a hole in the middle. But also the idea of the decatree was... if we turn off the left and right, we've got a mono recording, so it was mono compatible.
I see.
And of course, if you nowadays they'll have spot mics, outrigging mics, multiple stereo pairs, so wide stereo pair, cross stereo pair, Blumlein stereo pair sometimes, you know, or a Blumlein mic, which is one mic that is stereo.
Okay, all right, okay.
Anyway, so, but it feels like that approach has been taken as opposed to the rock, the
sort kind of close miking.
Close miking in a studio that's been deliberately dampened.
Yeah.
Have you got any overall thoughts while we finish off?
No, I mean, it's an enjoyable. If you like Christmas albums,
this one's for you. If you don't like Christmas albums and you don't like George Shearing,
probably avoid it. Yeah.
Don't.
Yeah, no. Yeah. But no, I enjoyed it. I like it. I think it's. I think it fits the bill. You know, it does what it says on the tin, as it were. And I'm looking forward to trying a couple out in real life
in central London
on the 9th of December.
And is that Monday?
Monday lunchtime.
Yeah. Monday lunchtime.
12:30. Spice of Life. Come and hear a couple of these played.
I might come along to that.
Yeah.
So I haven't heard your band live yet. and you need someone to come along and heckle.
Yeah, I'll be counting on you to come and heckle.
Does it say, I've just pulled it up on the Concord. Doesn't say where it's recorded here either.
No, I only know. I only know it's New York, but I don't know the actual.
Yeah,
that's something we can look up.
Anyway, I'm going to say Merry Christmas to you and to our listener. And I'm Simon Whiteside. Goodbye.
Merry Christmas from me, Nick Tomlin. Goodbye. So it was pretty good. It was about an hour, was it?